It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, we dig into our archives to play a show we first broadcast on this day in 2011. Attorney David Bell joins Macy Jones in a look at what happens when the trial is over and the cell door slams shut, separating attorney from client. Alvin Kirksey Bay and Sunshine join in to give their perspective. On the original broadcast, we opened the phone lines for calls from our listeners, but since this is a taped show, please hold your calls for another show. At the end of our show, we have a commentary by Keith Brown Ill, and as always, the 420 Drug War News after the show. Now, let's hear from David, Macy, Alvin, and Sunshine.
Good evening and welcome to the Jaws of Justice program this evening. My name is Macy Jones and I have guest panel with me, and at this time I would like to allow them to introduce themselves.
My name is Sunshine, also known as Artist Smith Eel. I'm a formerly incarcerated citizen with several college degrees, and I work with reentry of ex-offenders, and my specialization is women.
My name is Alvin. I have gone through every aspect of judicial system, incarceration, and reentry.
My name is David Bell. I'm a criminal defense attorney at Wersch Hobbs, Merakin, in Kansas City.
And I'd like to thank you, my guests, for being here this evening. And to you, my radio listening audience, I would like for you to know that you can also be a part in this discussion. And to take part in this discussion is simply to pick up the phone.
This is an archive edition of Jaws of Justice Radio. Please do not call in at this time.
And once again, my name is Macy Jones, and our discussion tonight is the system. Process from arrest to conviction, imprisonment, and reentry to society. So, David, by you being an attorney, how does this arrest to conviction take place?
Well, it starts out with an arrest. Usually that takes probable cause, more likely than not. That's then supported by, or should be supported by, a warrant, complaints issued, charging someone with a crime. It varies in different counties, but essentially at that point a case will then go to the grand jury or go to a preliminary hearing where evidence is heard. The grand jury makes a determination, or a judge makes a determination, that there is probable cause. And then someone's bound over for trial. And at that point, you get to either go to trial and take your chances on hopefully a not guilty verdict, or work out some type of disposition with a plea, or get a guilty verdict, and then you go to sentencing. And at that point, you're obviously always hoping for probation if you're found guilty, but in some cases, you're not going to get that. You're going to get some time, and you're going to get a lot of time. But the first part of the system that I'm interested in with some of our guests is the jail system. When the complaint is originally issued and a warrant's issued, you're given a bond. And a lot of people can't make bond, and I'd be interested. While I've been into jail a number of times for contact visits, I've never been on the other side of the glass. And I guess I'd kind of like to hear a little bit about that. And I guess the part that I'm interested in is, you put an orange jumpsuit on someone, that person is going to be treated differently than if you put a suit on somebody, just by the mere fact of the clothing that's put on. And I guess my question to the other individuals here is, does that orange jumpsuit, or whatever color it is, does that affect the way you think about yourselves? Does that affect the way you're living your life within the county jail?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It has actually no impact or effect on my psyche. It affects those who see me in this orange uniform and how they treat me, and I respond to the treatment that I receive from others.
But doesn't that in and of itself affect you? I mean, when you walk in a courtroom, and we've seen it before, I know in Jackson County especially, you got a long line of guys walking in almost like a chain gang, walking in orange, cuffed up, cuffed at the legs, and they're viewed differently.
Yeah, they are viewed differently by others. As a person in an orange jumpsuit, I do not view myself differently. And the other people who are in that chain gang or in that line, we do not view ourselves different than who we are, but those who look upon us see us as they are incarcerated, they are locked in jail, they have did wrong, and we are treated by those who observe us in a different manner, and that treatment causes a response. It doesn't change my views about myself, but it causes me to respond to those who approach in a different manner. For example, all forms of suspicions and paranoias crop up in my mind, even for my attorney. Trust issues is because I think, because I am viewed by others with the orange jumpsuit on, it's like, can I trust these people? Can I trust my attorney? Can I trust my public defender? I don't know anything about this process. I've been arrested before, and I have been mistreated as a result of, I have been get in that cell and shut up and, you know, do what you told and told a lie as a result of this jumpsuit. Well, of course, when I put my suit on again, you know, my regular three-piece or two-piece, and then the treatment is different. How are you, sir?
The orange jumpsuit is a way to stigmatize and label formerly or incarcerated citizens. They use it as a psychological and a control mechanism. They make sure that people view you differently. They don't really see you as a person. They see you as a perpetrator. They view you as someone who has gone against society's norms and values, and therefore they choose to stigmatize and label you, and it causes you to have some different interactions with people on the outside, whereas you have a different type of interaction with your fellow inmates and your fellow prisoners who are also required to wear the same thing. It's just another mechanism for the judicial system to stigmatize and label us.
Oh, and then along with that, you come to recognize that everyone that doesn't have on an orange jumpsuit is the enemy. They're getting ready to do something to you that you know you don't want done to you, but it's going to happen. And as it happens, God is sitting up there getting ready to make his judgment. The guy standing next to you might be on God's team, and now here you are, the only one that's playing ball by yourself.
Well, everybody else has on a suit, and I have on an orange jumpsuit. So,
that's the separation, not necessarily how you. Well, let me ask this. You said it didn't affect the way you viewed yourself, but the way you're talking, it sounds like it does. At least
because
to the
way I am treated,
right?
It has an impact and effect. Macy just pointed out, like, well, I'm the only one standing here in this room with a bright orange jumpsuit on. My attorney has his $300, $500, $1,000. Judge has his, you know, everybody's dressed. I don't want this jumpsuit, and they're looking at me. And I'm innocent. I didn't do it. I'm not guilty. I'm affected by that. I recognize who I am, but I am identified with in this orange jumpsuit as being, as she pointed out, a perpetrator, a criminal, an offender.
So let's talk about then briefly going forward with that, because I know we were talking before the show about the kind of this idea of separation, and not only mental, kind of a mental separation that goes on for people that are incarcerated. So it sounds to me like it starts with the orange jumpsuit, and then what about what's going on in the county? And maybe someone could talk the difference between a county, what the county means versus a prison.
The county versus a prison, David, is really just the breeding ground of the transformation process to what you're getting ready to walk into. What you're getting ready to walk into once that conviction is handed down is going to be totally different from what you into at that present moment. You will experience brief some of that because that would be the training process.
So tell me about the training process. So it starts with the orange jumpsuit. It starts with the chains. It starts with distinguishing you from everyone else in that courtroom. How does that mental process, how has it continued to be imposed upon you in the jail, in the county? Not the prison yet, because we haven't been sentenced yet, but the county.
Okay. Within that county comes, like I said, the training process. The training process is the gladiatorial aspect of what will take place.
So
for individuals, for example, an individual comes in, the strong will prey upon the weak. The strong will prey upon the weak. An individual come in and you're not strong enough to be able to stand on the fact of what's taking place, whatever it is, then you will be subjugated to the strength of the strong.
Someone give me an example of what that means in the county. We're talking physical violence. We're talking sexual violence. We're talking stealing people's commissary in the county. I mean, county, for example, Jackson County does not have a yard, so there's less room to roam. Maybe someone could talk about that.
The county jail is a systematic tool that's used. You're never moved without being handcuffed, shackled. They put you in with all different types of people with different crimes. You're not segregated by your crime. Somebody with a misdemeanor could be in the jail cell with a multiple murderer. But you must learn how to carry yourself, to keep yourself safe inside that institution. There's a saying that you can run, but you cannot hide. The easiest place to get to someone, to do something to someone, if you have other compadres on your crime, other defendants that could possibly be charged with you, they usually segregate you to different cell blocks, different, like in Jackson County, different floors. They try to keep you apart. It's all a process, but you have to get yourself together mentally to be able to face what it is that they are handing at you. And you are coming at it from an uneducated, most times, a street view, a criminal's view, whereas the system becomes your nemesis, and everything you do is to make the system work in your favor and for you to get the shortest sentence in the shortest time period and to be able to get through the county jail process and get to prison without having any altercations. And that is a very hard thing to do, especially with women. The inside the walls, even in the county jail, most times women's personal needs are not met. There are different attitudes, and there are mental health issues. People that are segregated for long periods of time, people come in that are under the influence of drugs and alcohol, they begin to detox. You have several different types of attitudes that you must adapt to on an immediate basis. You don't have time. There's no rule book.
It's an adjustment process, and I think it's a decision-making process for the individual. You decide for yourself certain things will or will not take place with you as an individual. It's a survival process, and as Sunshine pointed out, it's making it through the process. But certain things that I will not accept, certain things that you will not accept, certain things that we face death for in situations. The jail process is, it seems like it's all inclusive. Again, here's an individual who is in jail who has, see, I don't know anybody in here. I don't know how to function in here, so I have to make some decisions on what I will accept and what I will not accept, what I will rise to the occasion on and fight for and kill and die for, or what I will submit and go for.
So what's it like in the jail, a typical day in the jail, and then we'll move to prison? It just seems like time moves so much slower in the jail. I mean, a day, a 24-hour day. How do you describe it?
24-hour day. I mean, it's monotonous for sure. You know, it's drape and it's dragging along. Just make the best of the day. You try to do some exercise. You try to read. You try to communicate with your friends and family on the outside. You try to keep your brain focused. You try to communicate with the people that you live in there with.
And that 24-hour day is a daily routine. Mm-hmm. Like David, like you have your daily routine. You probably get up in the morning at 5:30 and do what you do. Well, we have a daily routine too, and our daily routine consists of counts at a particular time, eat at a particular time, go to bed at a particular time, and wake up and do it all over at another particular time. So that's pretty much the daily routine process for the incarcerated.
When I have clients that in the past that have gone to prison, families usually want to know when and how it's going to happen. Do any of you have a story of, I believe what the term is, pulling chain, of what happens that moment? Not just generally pulling chain, but the day you go, the day you physically go. What time do they come get you? How do they come get you? How do you know that you're going? What do they tell you to do? And the ride. Tell us about that.
They do not allow you to know when you're going to go. They will come to your cell block and tell you bag and baggage. They will call your name and call you bag and baggage. And most times it is such a, even though you've been sentenced for a crime and you're having issues and problems, it's a relief to come out of the county jail and go to a prison because you can have fresh air, whereas you're just kept on a cell block and in different areas in the county jail. At least at prison, it's a relief. You can get out. You have more privileges. You can have better visits. You can have you can have a little bit better food, a little bit better atmosphere to live in. But it's usually a relief to get out of the county jail and go to prison.
Well, for me, that was not a relief. It was for me throughout, and I knew when I was going. And I think after conviction and sentence, you generally anticipate and have some general knowledge about how long it takes to pull the chain. Mm-hmm. You know, and it depends on the type of conviction you have or how you have conducted yourself in that jail setting. The guards generally know, and this is a people situation, and we talk to the guards, and the guards talk to us. And it's 15 or 20 days, sometimes 2 or 3 days. I knew that I would be going to prison right away after I was convicted. And it was still jail to me. It was jail to me from the day that I was arrested to the time I arrived in prison. True, there are a few more liberties. You get out to walk around. You can get fresh air. You can exercise, communicate, interact, talk with others. But it's jail.
And the ride.
The ride
is that they ride you through your town. The town that you leave, and you get your ride through that. You know, you get to see the sights that you might that you're going to be leaving. Now it's a contemplation taking place. Now the reality of exactly what has taken place is weighing more heavily upon you than it was before. Now, as you're going down that highway, there is no communications. Ain't nobody really having the time to carry on no conversation. You ain't smoking no cigarettes and you ain't drinking no coffee. Because the next trip that you, or the next stop that you make, for some of us, or for myself, was at Jefferson City Penitentiary at that time. It wasn't no correction, nothing. It was the penitentiary. And the next sign you saw, we said, leave all your hopes and dreams behind. You are now entering the Missouri State Penitentiary. So to be told to leave all your hopes and dreams behind is the thought that I had when they put me on their bus, that they didn't have to let me read no sign to know what time it was.
So there was an actual sign with that print on there, leave all of your hopes behind.
Matter of fact, they'd have made that prison a museum now. And to my knowledge, that sign is still there. That sign is still there for you to read when you go in and view it for yourself as a citizen. You can go up there. I think you might have to pay $1.50 to get in. Well, I got in for free.
Yeah, it was an actual sign.
Yeah.
Chiseled, engraved into the stone.
You mean that someone, the tax dollars were used,
yes,
to pay someone to engrave that into?
Yes.
Do you all remember, or at least both of you remember, or all three of you remember seeing that exact,
yes,
engraving?
That exact sign.
Yes. Yes.
That sign.
Yes, it's actually engraved, and my memory serves me right. It was on the old building.
Right.
Which was known as H Hall, on the front of that building. The oldest part, it's probably built in the 1800s. So it was, you know, some years ago when things were not quite as civilized as they are today, if we can go with that thing. I'm interested also, before we get too far away and get all the way into the prison setting and into the transition process, in the process that takes place with the initial arrest and the actual warrant being issued and the placement in the county jail and the initial first contact with your attorney, the public defender's office, the most, you know, people end up with the public defenders if the families do not have money to purchase attorneys.
trust factors. Yeah, there's thousands, millions of stories. It's like, man, you don't want to mess with the public defender's office, man. They're sellouts. They work for the prosecuting attorney's office. I mean, you don't have nothing coming. They're going to try to make a deal right quick, like don't listen to nothing they say. So, but most of the people that's actually in jail who cannot make bond are pretty much stuck with the public defender's office. And how does the public defender's office wade through this gigantic trust factor?
Well, that's a good point. You know, I'd walk in. I'm a white guy from Johnson County, okay, and I know it. I mean, you know, there's no escaping it. And I'd walk up to a guy that grew up on the east side, generally African American, and I knew right off the bat there was going to be a trust factor, a problem. But I guess for myself, I tried to understand who my client was as a person, what their background was, what their experiences are, how they got to this day. And if they wanted to fight, then let's fight. The reality is there's going to be bad public defenders, just like there's going to be bad prosecutors, bad auto mechanics, bad any type of job. For the most part, what I found with public defenders, contrary to the view that you can't get any jobs, so they go become a public defender, that's not accurate. I left a job at a large firm in Kansas City making a bunch of money to go to the public defenders to make no money or very little money. But for the most part,
that's kind of hard to swallow and hard to believe.
It is. My parents are still getting over it, by the way. But it's true. And I guess what I'm saying, what I did it was for the passion. And I will tell you that at least in Jackson County, with the public defender's office there, that passion is rise throughout the office. Now there might be some bad apples, but there are going to be bad apples everywhere. But the passion is there to make sure that people don't get screwed. Right. And when you have an innocent client, it's the best and the worst, because you take that home with you. That person's life is riding on your shoulders. I still feel that today. And that's what motivates, that's what drives me. But how do I express to you as a client, right, as sitting in the county, looking at me, not, you know, knowing that I grew up different than maybe you grew up, all I can do is just talk to you and let you have an opportunity to get to know me, but I can't make you trust me. What you'll see, though, is when you see me fighting in court, and you see me taking on the prosecutor, and you see me fighting with the prosecutor, fighting with the court, that's when I think a certain level of trust enters into it. But I don't know. What are your thoughts? I mean, did you have
trust issues every step of the way, all the time, even with paid attorneys? It's like, hey, you belong to that system. You belong to that. I did not belong to that process. Remember, I'm the guy with the orange jumpsuit on. You know, so, I mean, I don't fit. And there's so many things for a common everyday guy coming off the block. He's arrested, guilty or innocent. So many circumstances, and who's listening to him? He has a public defender. I don't know, Dave. Everything I hear about Dave is exceptional, and he's somebody to be trusted. And these words travel through the county jail. People locked in jail say, man, okay, who's your public defender? So, well, I got Mary Green. Oh, man, you got the verse. She's going to cross you out. Well, I got David Bell. You got a good one there. You know, I mean, so people in jail talk. I mean, it's different from, like, a victim who...
So now with that, Mary Green is fired.
No. Mary Green is not fired. Mary Green is not. You can't get rid of her. Once she's stuck to you, it's like glue. You know, if you get rid of her, you're a bad client, and nobody wants to mess with you. I mean, so it's a lot of dynamics that plays into this process. I mean, it's like, I mean, naturally you think, well, I don't like this lawyer, I can fire her. Or I can try. That's what you think. You think you can fire her, but no, you can't. You fire her, she might start going with you. To flip the script a little bit for people that's incarcerated or locked in the county jail, and we share a tremendous amount of information on who's who and what's what, and I was just thinking about the victim. You know, the victim does not have that benefit available to them. The victim is sitting at home in a small, quiet room, probably scared to death, trying to heal from a gunshot wound or what have you, or some insane attack. And there's no one for the victim to talk to. Of course, the guy who actually did it, or even if he's innocent, he has everybody to talk to, everybody in the county jail who knows about this process. So, you know, I mean, the judicial system, the prison, we're switching from the judicial system to the executive branch of the government when we talk about getting off the bus in the prison. We're out of the judicial system.
We'd like to take this moment for a brief PSA.
You beat up your butcher and you bleed a man. You bang up a badger and bloodlet a man.
Welcome once again to the Jaws of Justice program this evening. I have on the show with me today Mr. David Bell, who is an attorney. I have Sunshine, who is an advocate for individuals that are coming from the prison setting to the reentry aspects. And I have with me Alvin, you know, not Alvin of the Chipmunks, but Alvin.
Hey, we can go with that one.
Yeah, who is a part of this system, not only from knowing it, from being on one side of it, but also having some knowledge of the law as well. And like, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the show. And I also, you, our listening audience, I'd like to welcome you as well. And you have an opportunity at this time to call in.
This is an archive edition of Jaws of Justice Radio. Please do not call in at this time.
And we ask that you make keep your comments brief and to the point, and stay true to the point, because there are those who others who would like to get in and say what they would like to say as well. Is there a caller on the line? We have a caller. You're on the air, caller.
How you doing?
What is your name and what part of
I'm
going
to go by the Puppet Master. That was the name they gave me when I was in the Johnson County Jail.
Okay.
I was in there on a DUI. I just wanted to state that it was kind of a humiliating process. We all wore the stripes. You know, I had a real range of people I was in an eight-man cell with. And it was just kind of a dehumanizing thing. We got an orange spoon when we went to get our meal. You know, we got in line. And I'm writing a thing called DUI, the musical, The Road to Recovery. And it's kind of a rockumentary about the ridiculousness of the system and how they make money at every stage of it. The defense and the prosecution lawyers are all in cahoots with each other, and you just make deals. They don't really, you know, do anything. You know, a public defender and a $10,000 lawyer get you about the same result.
All right, thank you, Colin. Mr. Bill, would you like to answer that for the call?
I would like to answer that. First of all, the in bed part, I used to get that a lot as a public defender, that I was in bed with a prosecutor, and I have to tell you, and I'm a private attorney now doing criminal defense, that was never the case, and it's still not the case. The reality is when I'm friendly to a prosecutor, professional to a prosecutor, first of all, I try to be professional to everyone. But with a prosecutor, what good would it do my client for me to go up and not be professional with the prosecutor? As to whether we socialize outside of work, no, we never did. And, in fact, it's a differing view a lot of times of life, at least as I've seen it, as to who can do prosecutorial work, who can do defense work. Some people can do both. I could never be a prosecutor. It would be very difficult for me to be a prosecutor because even someone who belongs in prison, and there are some people out there that do belong in prison, okay, it would not be a good day for me to see that person go, even though they might belong in prison. But what I'd like to ask the three of you, going back to this question of the bus ride, I want you to take me there. I want you to take me, you're on the bus. How are you sitting? Are you shackled? Are you not shackled? You pull up to the prison. Do gates open? Do you get off the bus in some type of order? What do you see? What's going through your mind?
In the back of a station wagon leaving Shawnee County Jail, headed to Lansing Correctional Facility on the Hill. I was in a station wagon, and excuse me just a moment. I was in a station wagon, and there at the bottom of the station wagon, on the floor of it, there were hooks where we were shackled to the hooks. We were also shackled at the waist. We were handcuffed. I was set in between three other individuals in a station wagon, and there were some people that were actually shackled to a hook facing backwards in the back of a station wagon. But we must take into consideration this was in the between 75 and 1975 and 1980. They usually do shackle you down. They have ankle bracelets on you, and you have to learn how to scoot and shuffle walk For women, they take you in your street clothes that you were arrested in, unless, like in my case, all of my clothes were illegally purchased through credit cards at different conveyances of monetary donations. And so they came and took all my clothes, so I was only allowed at state clothes. When I got off the bus at Lansing, there were a group of ladies who lined the sidewalk as I scooted and shuffled in my handcuffs and my ankle bracelets down the sidewalk. There were comments made as to where I'd be living and who I'd be living with. There were other things. I was fortunate enough to jump off the sidewalk onto someone and went straight to the hole until my 2 weeks of I was down there for 2 weeks in the hole before they actually took me into general population. I established right away as to what I would stand for and what I wouldn't. As Brother Alvin has said, you have to establish yourself as to what you will accept and what you won't accept.
That's right. Just chains, chains and shackles. It's one chain that runs down. Well, I was on a bus. One chain that runs from the front all the way to the back. Two seats, like a greyhound. You shackle to another individual, hand, one hand, leg irons, and a chain running down between the seats connected to the hand. And beyond that, is, I mean, you got guards with weapons.
You on the air, caller?
Yeah, I wanted to ask...
what is your name and what part of town are you calling from?
My name is Frank. I'm calling from Brookside area.
Okay. Go ahead, Frank.
I wanted to ask the public defender a question about all this DNA evidence that's exonerating a lot of people that have been in prison for a long time, and why it's so hard to get prosecutors and others to admit their mistakes and reopen cases more quickly when the scientific evidence is clear that something went wrong, and what could be done about that in your view?
Thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a great question, and obviously we just had someone exonerated in Texas after serving 30 years for a crime that he didn't commit. I can't answer from a prosecutor's perspective because I don't know, never been a prosecutor. What I can tell you is there is a desire in the system for finality, number one. And two, it takes a special person to look back and say, hey, I made a mistake, and not only did I make a mistake, but that mistake cost someone years of their life and maybe their family and their friends and their financial existence. That is probably very difficult to overcome, but I've never had to face that. My hope is that all states would enact legislation that would permit the testing of biological evidence if biological evidence was collected and still exists.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, that testing should be done earlier in the process as opposed to waiting till you done got somebody incarcerated for 30 to 40 years. And then once you release them and they have been proven that they are not the ones who committed the crime, what type of compensation can you afford this individual that will give him some type of stability where he don't have to commit a crime to go back to eating?
Well, that's a good point. Here's, and I think what we've seen over the course of history, at least in the last, let's say, 30 years maybe, evidence has gotten, the scientific evidence has gotten a lot more refined and is a lot better at identifying individuals. So whereas it used to solve crimes by lineups, by picking someone out of a photo array, which is usually the least reliable method, especially cross-racial identification, now if you can pinpoint someone at a crime scene with DNA, what I've seen is I've seen law enforcement using that technology, but that technology is of more recent origin. It hasn't been around for a long time. And then the question becomes, if 40 years ago or 30 years ago in this guy's case, a crime scene was called out, did they collect the right evidence that would eventually be able to be tested by technology that had not yet been developed? And that's really part of the concern.
Well, it's also part of the concern is collecting DNA evidence is the ticket is pretty much pushed by the prosecutor. They had the funding, the money. The defendant, who is working with the public defender, he does not have the money. It is not available. And so that ticket is difficult to push. In prisons,
here in Missouri, DNA is collected from every individual who is currently locked up in the system. And of course, they are told that if DNA can be used to prove that you are innocent, then this is DNA that will be used. But there are very few that I know of in the Missouri system who have benefited from the mass collection of DNA. However, on the other side of the coin, many people who were in the system whose DNA was forcefully connected, they have been convicted of other crimes. So, again, it's a ticket as it stands today being pushed by the prosecution because they have the money, the state they have the money.
So, Alvin, let's real quick getting back to your ride down. I want to go from now. You walk off the bus that you've been talking about with the chains. You walk into a yard. What do you see, or what are people doing?
In the Missouri penitentiary, you didn't walk. There were no people around. Well, there were people who were in minimum security. At a place called Air Hall, working in the garage, and you could see them, but there was no gawking, there was no one lined up, you know, checking out the new people coming in.
That's pretty much your lower custody institution.
Minimum custody institution. At Jefferson City State Penitentiary, you were taken immediately into an intake area. Long tables, you were totally disrobed, undressed, shackles taken off, of course, totally disrobed, undressed, and moved from that area one or two at a time into a large shower room where you were disinfected with disinfection.
What do you mean disinfected?
You know, sprayed with whatever that stuff was they spray on you and stuff that they throw in your hair and, you know, for lice.
De-liced.
Yeah, de-liced.
Like you would do with your dog, yeah. You know, your dog or your cat, you know.
We were dipped.
Let me understand this just to what you're talking about. You were stripped down in one room and you're completely naked.
Totally.
You go into another room that looks like a shower?
Just a large room that the shower is close by.
And then powder's poured on you, a liquid's poured on you?
Yes.
And then what happened?
And then you shower, and then you're given a jumpsuit to put on. It's out of the orange into the white or blue.
And it may fit, and it may not.
So from there, it's a long processing of taking your... I mean, same thing that goes on in the police station when you're arrested. Taking your fingerprints, taking pictures, gathering information...
Medical examination.
Medical exam did not take place for another couple of days.
Right.
You know, just getting you processed into the prison and into a cell and getting you getting some food and getting you situated to your cell.
Now, this
orientated
is
toward
at that point, Alvin, is when now that process of people being able to see you actually taking place. You know, the tears, individuals on the tears, the walkmen that you lock down 24 hours. You have the walkmen or someone of that nature that will come around and bring you little cleaning items and things of this nature to clean your cell.
So what's going through your head at that time when you realize that now you can be seen by the other inmates there?
What went through my head is all or nothing.
What does that mean?
That means kill, be killed. You know, and nothing else is going to take place.
Well, basically, what's going on in my head at that time is, who do I know in here? Who do I recognize? Anybody? People who I met in the county jail, people who I knew from this, you know, prior to me being arrested, people who had come to prison prior to my arrival. I'm trying to, you know, just get my bearings and see, just in case I have some problems, who can I reach out to? I'm definitely, one thing is for an absolute certainty. In my mind, it is an absolute no-no to talk to the guards who are supposed to be there to protect you. But be that as it is, maybe they are there, and I have saw some guards actually put their lives on the line to protect people from being bludgeoned to death or stabbed to death and themselves getting killed. So be that as it is, the rule is, with my mind, my presence of mind, and my arrival in prison was like, I don't want to talk to you on no level because of the indoctrination that takes place in society, in the county jail, and it's a perpetuation. It continues. these are my thoughts, and I didn't arrive at these thoughts by myself. Do not talk to the police. You would be labeled as a snitch, and that is real bad.
And police, that term applies to anybody wearing a uniform.
Yes.
Women are taken to, when you get off the bus and stuff, you're supposed to go to an infirmary situation. They put you in hospital gowns, and they keep you down there for approximately 2 weeks until you're cleared medically to go into general population. In that time, you'll get a psychological evaluation. You'll see a classification specialist who will decide where you live, which cell block you go to, if you have a job detail, what any health issues are. We've had women have seizures from epilepsy and stuff and receive absolutely, we're banging on doors trying to get the doctors, nurses, a guard, somebody to come and help us in. We had to basically achieve our own medical interventions for anybody that was down there in the infirmary and also in the penitentiary just on a daily basis. For women, it's especially hard because, you know, we have special health needs and things that go on with us on a monthly basis. And a lot of times we're ostracized and caused to be in a very uncomfortable position if we do not have money to purchase the items that will help us get through those type of situations. From my point of view, for the incarceration of women, it's a little different than it is for the men. But on a whole, we're just as dangerous as they are. We live with killers. We live with molesters. We live with people that will take your life for no other reason than they're just having a miserable day. So you have to be constantly on guard and aware of your situations and your surroundings.
And this arrival is the basic mental. It's the basic testing ground. Pretty much in this orientation process is generally decided where you will fit into this food chain, what you will actually be in this process. And from there, it's just a process.
Well, how is it decided?
It's decided by everybody who is there. It's decided by other people locked in with you. It's decided by staff. It's how it is decided.
And also, we got to look at this reentry aspect of things, too, you know. Alvin, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's where we were going from. After he asked how it is decided. It's decided based on how you represent yourself. And once the decision is made, you're pretty much stuck with
it. But give me the extremes. Give me the who occupies the highest level, and how they're treated, and give me what the lowest level means.
Okay, the highest level. The pecking order, the food chain, is murderers, lawyers, people who know how to help other people. They represent a really high order. Murderers represent a very high echelon in the pecking order. Of course, child molesters are on the bottom of the rug. That's the bottom of the totem pole. Rapists are pretty low on the totem pole. So that's high and low.
You're on the air, caller.
Hi.
What is your name and what part of town are you calling from?
My name is Bobby Lane, and I'm from Kansas City, Kansas.
Go ahead, caller.
And I actually was calling the attorney, David Bell, seems to have had some questions about the process or the, you know, like what do you feel as you're going into the prison?
Correct.
And coincidentally, his questions kind of made me think of a book that my cousin had just written. He's actually incarcerated in the Missouri Department of Corrections, Crossroads, and it's called So Far from Paradise, and even though I'm sure parts of the book mirrors his life, it talks about his experience going to jail and the ride to jail and the process of where the one guy says they spray you down and then you're classified and... You know, it might be if he would like I could send him a couple of chapters of that chapter because it really gets into it.
Okay, Colin, if we would, we're limited on our time. So if we could, you said there's a book called what?
It's So Far from Paradise.
So Far from Paradise. So we look forward to acquiring that book and seeing how it turns out. Is there a question that you have, though?
You know, I do, because I kind of, this may be a question or a comment.
Okay.
Because I, as a relative, I have two cousins that are incarcerated through the Missouri Department of Corrections. And at one point, my father, and as with many extended families, one of the things I've been kind of battling with the Missouri Department of Corrections, I don't know if he could really advise on this, is that I had a concern that they have these rules with their visiting.
Okay.
And in order to visit or be on the visiting list, in the state of Missouri, you can only be on one inmate's list. Well, my two cousins, who are brothers and both incarcerated at the Missouri at Crossroads, they really don't have, like, a lot of outside support. With me being a first cousin, they haven't allowed me to visit.
Okay, then, Carla, I would briefly speak to that.
Just contact the Constituent Services Office at Jefferson City. They generally deal with those, and I'm pretty confident that they will. You can get on a number of visitors lists. I wanted to talk a little bit about the reentry process. We have a few minutes left. reentering society after extended periods in prison. In Missouri, sentences are people are confined to the prison system for very long periods of time. And I'm talking about beyond 5 years after having been incarcerated. Beyond 5 years, there is some serious disassociation with society. There are some psychological problems with reentering society, being accepted, or just reassimilating, reassociating with reintegrating, being accepted. It's once you have been placed in this orange jumpsuit that David Bell talked about, it's perpetual. It lasts for the rest of your life.
I'd like to thank my guests for being here this evening, Mr. David Bell, Sunshine, and Albert, and you, our listening audience. And I would also like to say to you, our listening audience, you either get involved and be a part of the changing of the system and recognizing what is taking place, or sit back and don't say nothing at all. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I have a commentary I would like to share with our listeners this morning. The name of it is Wrongful Incarceration of Innocent People. As always, the statements made in this commentary are solely my own opinions and do not reflect the views of the management and staff here at KKFI or the Mid-Coast Radio Project. During the last few years, we have seen too many people who were wrongfully incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. Robert Nelson and Ryan Ferguson are two of Missouri's most recent examples of wrongfully convicted persons who were successful in getting the Show Me State to acknowledge it had made some serious blunders. However, these two men had the luck that was roughly the equivalent of a major jackpot lottery winner. And there's reason to believe that the total number of those serving time unjustly is far greater than most people suspect. Even a modest estimate of those in Missouri would probably be in the hundreds. This is a very tragic flaw in our judicial system and is due to quite a long list of reasons which time will not permit me to mention in this brief commentary. However, if you know somebody who has been a victim of wrongful incarceration, you are probably thinking that his or her individual case is unique and that all they really needed was the proper outside support to make the state acknowledge its injustice, and then it would gladly correct the error. Well, at the risk of disappointing you, I am compelled to inform you that you are wrong. Many state officials with the power to overturn and correct wrongful convictions are well aware that there are far too many people in situations just like yours or one you may know of. And these officials simply don't care. It costs hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars just to prosecute someone accused of committing a crime. This does not include what it will cost to keep them locked up for years. So the state has no interest in trying to clean up this huge mess they have created, or in subjecting the state of Missouri to having to pay out $50 a day for every person who has been wrongfully confined. There is no way these officials are ever going to acknowledge that they waste this much money every year sending so many innocent people to jail. So let me be clear.
Prison equals big bucks for judges, politicians, and other top law enforcement officials. And there is no reason other than greed and corruption why any government official would oppose the release of a wrongfully convicted person. Innocent people are not criminals, and they do not deserve to be treated as such simply because the state failed to properly do its job. Innocent people have an absolute right to be released from confinement, no matter how belated the discovery of their exonerating evidence is. Procedural bars set by rules of the court have impeded the cause of justice. Gubernatorial discretion authorized by the Constitution to commute sentences has failed to right the wrongs committed in courts. The process which Missouri now has in place to exonerate innocent people isn't working and needs to be fixed. It has resulted in far too many people languishing unnecessarily and unjustly in prison for years and even decades. And for those on death row, it can cost them their lives if it hasn't already. I, too, am a formerly incarcerated individual, a.k.a. suspect, outlaw, criminal, and convicted felon. I have never claimed to be innocent of the crimes for which I was in prison, but during my 36-year period of confinement, I have met many men who did, and a lot of them had claims that were valid. I have been out of confinement now for over 5 years, and during that time, I have been working with KKFI, Missouri Cure, and other organizations whose purpose is to gather and distribute essential information to the public. Therefore, the information I am giving our listeners this morning is this. We are living in an age of lunatic, pathetic politicians and other public officials who seek to build their careers and reputation on a Rush Limbaugh philosophy. That is to say, mistrust, bigotry, paranoia, the rich against the poor, and a world where the powerful can silence and crush those under their feet who are without power. At this very moment, they are calculating on just how much finance they are going to need to incarcerate children still in grade school. Even as this commentary is being broadcast, tests are being conducted on your children to determine which ones are likely to end up in prison. So how are we going to change this prison nightmare we are living in while in prison and out in society? The FCC won't let me tell you that on these airwaves, but I can tell you this. Stay alert. Stay aware. Watch the eagle. Watch the bear.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clemmer on Thursdays, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Don't keep that smile on my face. Don't teach myself how to understand. Gonna make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Following, courtesy MSNBC.
Mary Jane, ganja, chronic hash, smoke, bud, weed, pot, or just plain marijuana. Once a political liability, it's now almost mundane. More than 20 years ago, President Clinton said he puffed, but he did inhale. President Obama revealed his pot use in an autobiography more than a decade before running for office. And now, with the legalization of the licensed production and retail of marijuana in both Colorado and Washington, who knows how many public officials will now openly admit to enjoying a little Mary Jane with no political repercussions. According to a recent Gallup poll, a sizable majority of Americans, 58%, now agree that marijuana should be legalized. Further illustrating the mainstreaming of marijuana is the selection of 36-year-old Robert Jacob this month as mayor of the town of Sebastopol, California, which is just north of San Francisco. With what's so special about Robert Jacob? Well, he's the founder of the town's medical marijuana dispensary. And according to advocates for marijuana legalization, that makes him the first person from the medical marijuana industry to become mayor of a city in the United States. And he may not be the last. Because this week, Colorado became the first state to issue special licenses to businesses that will begin selling recreational marijuana on January 1st. Joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is Mason Tavert, who is Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project, who helped run the campaign for Colorado's marijuana initiatives. Nice to see you this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so talk to me. What is the key change that occurs at the new year in terms of the purchase and sale of marijuana in Colorado?
Well, essentially, all that's really going to happen here is that Coloradans who have been buying marijuana for years will now have the ability to buy it from licensed, legitimate, tax-paying businesses instead of from the underground market, where it would otherwise be benefiting cartels and other criminal enterprises. And the state will be generating tens of millions of dollars in revenue that otherwise would have gone into the underground market. So Mason, it's really a step forward.
Yeah, so Mason, I want to break out those two and think about them a little bit. So first, talk to me about the importance of this, simply from that first part of what you were talking about, the kind of legal reform, war on drug, kind of crimes perspective. How much does this change that in the state of Colorado?
Well, this is essentially going to eliminate the underground marijuana market for adult use. Basically, we're going to have retail marijuana stores that are open and available to people. They simply have to show proof of age in order to make a purchase. And in doing so, they will not have to go to the underground market where they might be exposed to other illegal drugs, and they won't be giving their money to criminals.
Drug war. You either fund the criminals to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year, or you don't. Some politicians think we shouldn't do that. DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.